Good morning. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case this morning is 2020-1533, the State of Ohio Bar Association versus Harvey Bruce Bruner. And you will notice that Justice Donnelly is not on this case. And in his stead, we have Judge Christine Miley from the 6th District Court of Appeals. Welcome, Judge. For the respondent, Mr. O'Shea.
Thank you, Your Honor. If it please the court, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I may, Your Honor, and may I proceed?
Proceed.
Thank you. If it please the court, Your Honor, justices of the Supreme Court, let it be known that notwithstanding whatever you've read in the context of the briefs that were filed, that I can speak on behalf of my co-counsel, Mr. Housel, as well as my client, Mr. Bruner, that we have the greatest respect for the board process and what we're doing here today. Given the fact that we had COVID, given the fact that this case took an unusually long period of time, it may appear that there was some sort of disingenuous feeling about our counsel on the other side. Not true. I hope I made that clear in our brief. Now, having said that, if I may, justices, I would like to address the court on the issues in the matter, pretty much as I set forth in our objections. First and foremost, I have never had a situation where a fact witness was blended into somehow being part of counsel. And I speak of Mr. Tierney in the subpoena, where we were not able, in any case I've ever been involved with, to interview, depose, or get information from a purely fact witness. Mr. Tierney never appeared as counsel in this case, but was told or promoted as being someone that is part of the team, and therefore whatever he did was confidential, including interviewing apparently Mr. Walton at one point, including apparently, although we couldn't be clear because we weren't able to ask Mr. Tierney whether or not he in fact interviewed Mr. Ortega Sr. or Mr. Ortega Jr. This court has spoken so many times on the fact that there should be no gamesmanship at all. We cite a case, the Stafford case, that talks about that, and that the rules of civil procedure, which I believe Relator agrees apply here, are to eliminate surprise and trial by ambush. So they had information that we thought was relevant. We weren't allowed to see it. And at the very least, I think as we argued in our motions, our brief in opposition to the motion to quash, as well as our, that at the very least, they should have preserved the Tierney records for an in-camera review, be it by the panel chair or by at least this court. I don't even think that was done. So this court, as well as the panel itself, was essentially buying a pig and a poke when it comes to the idea of what was in the knowledge of Mr. Tierney and what did he did. What did he do? In addition to that, we had the same arguments relative to the Oakley subpoena that we were trying to pursue. Attorney Oakley didn't even respond to the subpoena. Nobody filed a motion to quash. We had to file a motion to compel, and the court just summarily overruled that. Now, one of the big themes of our case being at the discovery phase or during the hearing that we had in October of last year is, and you've heard the argument, due process. Apparently, Relator believes that due process stops completely with the filing of a complaint, and that anything that happens after that, anything, is not part of the due process inquiry. And that's the way I read their brief. So for instance, if someone gets indicted, justices, and thereafter all kinds of crazy things happen in the case, reversible error, the prosecution could never stand up and say, well, look, they read the complaint, they were on notice of the charges, due process has been satisfied. I believe I read the term of the word complaint in their brief about 25 to 30 times. Complaint. They said we filed the complaint. He read the complaint. He understood the complaint. Filed an answer to the complaint. Due process was served because of that. But as this court has held, and as the 8th District Court of Appeals has recently held, due process involves two things. You know, the right to go through the evidence in a fair and open way. And secondly, notice of the charges. You get both in due process, both. This court has spoken on it. The United States Supreme Court has spoken on it. Now, one of the things that we consistently heard, and it became somewhat confusing that day of the hearing in October, is, well, are you guys ready to call witnesses? And the fact is, nobody was ready to call witnesses that day, including Relator. There's no question, and they cannot sit here with a straight face and tell this court that they had witnesses in the bullpen ready to go. The only thing that we were going to do on the record that morning was put on the, you know, the consent to discipline, the stipulations and the like. There were no witnesses available. And the vast majority of Relator's counsel, with all due respect to them and understanding their logistics, were people that were in prison. And getting that, getting to them like we're doing today through Zoom and the like was logistically difficult, which is why the weekend before the commencement of that hearing in October, that, you know, through the efforts of my co-counsel, Mr. Housel, and the efforts of counsel for the Relator, that they hammered out this resolution that we set forth in the stipulation. So,
counsel, can I ask, why would it be that the attorneys were not prepared to go forward with the hearing, given that the procedural regulations state that the panel has the option of taking the case on the papers or holding the hearing? Shouldn't they have been prepared to go forward?
I believe the answer to that is yes, with one caveat, if I may, Judge, and that is this. The counsel for the Relator and Mr. Housel worked that weekend to work out these stipulations. As you could tell, they're pretty long. They're pretty lengthy and stuff like that. That consumed their time. I think that every lawyer involved, every attorney of record, was unconditionally convinced that there was no necessity to call witnesses. It's sort of like, as we say in our brief, it's like a plea in a criminal case. You come in the morning of the plea and the prosecutor says, this is what the plea arrangement is. The defense lawyer agrees. But in this case, using that same analogy, the judge said, no, I'm not accepting the plea. And instead, judge, of remanding it for a hearing and say, come back another day, let's serve this, let's serve due process. Instead, the judge goes, I'm going to find you guilty of the counts in the indictment that the prosecutor wants to dismiss without ever allowing the defendant to have a hearing. And that's functionally what occurred in October of last year at this, at the hearing that we were set for. And I could tell you that nobody who appeared at that hearing as counsel for any of the parties was prepared to call witnesses. As a matter of fact, as I understand it, Relator has the burden of proof. Their witnesses should have been in the bullpen. Ours would come later, but certainly they would have had their witnesses in the bullpen if they believe that everyone should have been ready. And the only witness they called at all was one person, and that was Mr. Bruner. That's it. They had no one else in their pitcher bullpen, nobody. So I hope I answered your question, Your Honor, but that's what happened. And I don't know how much of the record reflects that, but certainly the transcript that we have from that hearing will indicate exactly what the conversations were and what the expectations were of the folks. So I guess I'm confused as to where that would place somebody like Mr. Bruner, like somebody who, you know, even the Relator has indicated in their answer that the nature of these proceedings in front of the board are quasi-criminal in nature. So they have agreed with the thrust of our argument, saying that, you know, Mr. Bruner stands accused in a quasi-criminal type of proceeding, and it's up to Relator to prove the charges. In this case, to prove the 8.4 charges that are really the focal point of why we're here today, and they didn't have those witnesses ready to go. They couldn't make their case simply with Mr. Bruner at all. So I guess my suggestion is to ask them, were your witnesses ready? And my understanding from the hard work that Mr. Housel spent all day Saturday and Sunday before the hearing was that no witnesses need to be called. We've got these stipulations signed. We're going to submit them to the panel, and we're going to do this. It's a functional consent to a discipline type of scenario.
The rule states that the hearing panel may accept or reject the agreement. Now, I know it was submitted pretty late, but was it specifically rejected? Because it's at that point that the matter would be set for a hearing.
Justice Berner, exactly my point, and exactly the point of our brief. If the panel didn't want to accept the consent to discipline stipulations, reject it. and send it. We'll gladly live with a rejection and have a hearing on the Walton Ortega matters. We're ready to go. Give us our day in court on that. That's all Mr. Bruner wants. We're ready to try that part of the case. The other matters, all the other cases, I think everybody agreed. We had an agreement there. It's the Walton and Ortega matters and the triggering of this 8.4 violation that really changed everything. It surprised everybody. And I'm not going to speak for Relators Counsel, but I'd certainly surprise myself and Mr. Housel, a very seasoned lawyer, that happened.
Counsel, there is a difference between stipulations and a consent to discipline, correct?
There is on paper, Your Honor, Justice.
Not just on paper, as a matter of legal basis.
Yeah, technically, the consent to discipline actually has a deadline on it, Fisher. But nevertheless, despite the fact that the deadline had passed, Relators Counsel and Mr. Housel worked out this agreement. So I'm not sure whether we call it an apple or an orange. It's still a piece of fruit. And the idea was that this case was resolved. So, and if the panel thought that it shouldn't be resolved on Ortega and Walton, please just remand it. In the interest, be it pursuant to the Rule 5 of the Rules of the Government of the Bar or due process, take your pick.
Mr. O'Shea, the panel chair was using the standard of review as clear and convincing, but I don't find that in the rule. What is the standard?
My understanding is it's clear and convincing. I think everyone agrees that that's the standard when it comes to, certainly with an 8.4 violation. And I see my time, Your Honor, I can't see the clock as well as you do, but I have myself just approaching 10 minutes.
10 minutes? No, you have 3 minutes and 45 seconds left.
With that, total time, Your Honor?
Yes, that's what you have left. Right now, okay. It's, yes.
Then I will reserve the rest, Your Justices. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Roberts.
Good morning. May it please the court, Chief Justice O'Connor and other distinguished members of this honorable court. My name is James Roberts, and I'm appearing today on behalf of the Ohio State Bar Association. Today, I'll discuss generally three main matters. First, I'll outline why due process in this matter was met and the defendant was afforded all due process protections, and also talk a little about the case law and the facts that support that. Second, I'll talk about the why respondents' pretrial motions were properly overruled. And thirdly, why the sanction recommended by this panel was appropriate. Before I get into those things, I do want to address one thing that was brought up by Mr. O'Shea. The relator in this matter was fully prepared and ready to go to trial. We negotiated a settlement on the weekend before the Monday trial, predominantly on the Sunday before the trial. We didn't reach an agreement until late that Sunday night at 10, 11 o'clock in the evening, the day before trial. We had all of our witnesses lined up, ready to go in the bullpen, ready to testify. We had technology checks with the DRC. We had all of the witnesses that are inmates in the Department of Rehabilitation and Correction ready to go and scheduled to testify. We had other witnesses throughout the state and in other states on standby, ready to go. We were fully ready to prepared and ready to try this case. We had all our witnesses lined up and ready to go. We had no idea until we went in there the morning of October 13th, whether the panel was going to accept the stipulations. So we were prepared and ready to go to trial. At this point, I'd like to turn to the due process issues that Mr. O'Shea touched upon briefly. First, I think with regard to the due process issues, there are two cases, I think, directly on point that shed light on this particular matter. The first is the United States Supreme Court case in In re Ruffalo, and second, prior decision from this court, Disciplinary Counsel versus Reinheimer. First, in In re Ruffalo, the United States Supreme Court set out kind of the broad, in that case, there was a situation where There was no charge that was included in the complaint. It was not raised at any time, any point prior to the proceedings in the hearing. And it was based, the new charge was based upon the testimony that happened that day at the hearing. And the United States Supreme Court said, that's not due process. Now, if we look to this court's prior decision in Disciplinary Counsel versus Reinheimer, it gives us a little bit better of a guidepost on what the rules are for procedural due process. And what the Reinheimer court said is that if a defendant, that procedural due process is met, if the defendant is put on notice, if the violations are contained in the complaint. In this particular case, the 8.4C allegations were included in the OSBA's original complaint. Reinheimer also stands for the proposition that if a complaint is amended prior to the proceedings, that constitutes due process, and further, that parties can try matters by express or implied consent, even if it's not in the pleadings. In this particular matter, the 8.4C violations with regard to Walton and Ortega were continuously levied from, they were set out in the August 30th, 2019 complaint. They were continuously levied from that point until the day of the hearing. And even during the course of the hearing, panel chair Green made it very clear to the respondent during the course of the proceeding that the professional conduct 8.4C violations were still on the table in this matter. And panel chair Green specifically said, the panel has the responsibility of addressing all information that comes before us. And he went on to say that we do not accept the withdrawal of the charges that relator has not pursued, referring to, among other things, the professional conduct 8.C violations.
Counselor, let me ask you about one of his more specific claims. Did he get all the investigatory materials that he asked for and was entitled to?
Yes, during the course of the discovery in this matter, we produced basically our entire file to respondent. The only thing that we did not produce are two memos, and respondent's counsel mentioned this in his argument with regard to the tyranny issue. So in that particular, those two memos were, one, they were not properly disclosed under Rule 5, Section 8A1, and also they were protected by work product.
Well, let me ask you that, Counselor, because it seems that you're making a work product argument that goes well beyond what the rule allows. Governor Barr Rule V8B3 says the summary of investigation prepared by the relator shall be confidential as work product relator. All other investigatory materials, any attachments prepared in connection with the investigation shall be discoverable as provided in the Ohio Rules of Civil Procedure. So, I mean, as I read that rule, the only thing that's work product in this proceeding is a summary of the investigation.
I understand your question. I think before we get to that, if we look to Rule 5, Section 8, A1 provides that prior to the determination of probable cause, that the materials are confidential and not subject to disclosure.
But he asked these after the determination of probable cause, right?
Right. And so there's two things here, Your Honor. First, tyranny started out with an investigation on a couple of these matters. And then as more allegations, more grievances came in, they were assigned to myself and Mr. Mankin. We began investigating those. And at some point, Mr. Tierney, he's in private practice, he's in Cincinnati. These claims were based out of Cleveland. His investigation was closed down. Those complaints were transferred over to us. So with regard to Mr. Tierney's investigation, I think first, that was closed prior to determination of probable cause. However, even if that's, you know, not the way this court would interpret Rule 5, Section 8.1A, which I believe is the correct interpretation.
Why are we even looking at that? It still would be an investigator investigatory materials under Rule 58B3, so it would be discoverable.
Well, even under Rule 58B3, there is a provision in it that says that the disclosure of materials pursuant to Rule 5, Section 83B are discoverable as provided in the Ohio Rules of Civil Procedure. And the work product doctrine is recognized by the Ohio Rules of Civil Procedure.
Hold on. But I mean, to be fair, that's a pretty disingenuous argument, because what the rule says is the summary of investigation prepared by the relator shall be confidential as work product of the relator, period. Then all other investigatory materials shall be discoverable as provided in the Ohio Rules of Civil Procedure. Now, clearly, that second sentence doesn't say that we ignore the first sentence. There'd be no need if anything that's otherwise was work product was not discoverable. There would be no need for the first sentence in the paragraph. I mean, clearly that this rule gives him a right to any investigatory materials except the summary of the investigation.
So I think the difference here, let me just back up and add some facts in here to clarify this particular issue. Kevin Tierney is a member of the Ohio State Bar Association Certified Grievance Committee. He's an attorney licensed to practice law. When he initially looked at these matters, everything that was gathered in the file has been produced. These two memos, however, were work product in which he was relaying information and advice to the committee based on his legal impressions of the scenario and his analysis of the particular matters. And those are the very definition of work product.
Its own definition. And the only thing that's work product is the summary of investigation prepared by the relator. The rules seem pretty clear that he's entitled to that. I mean, so why not give it to him? Why wouldn't you?
Well, I respectfully, Your Honor, I believe that I don't think that the proper interpretation of Rule 5, Section 8, A3 is that the only document in anywhere in a case like this that's not disclosable is the summary of investigation. I think that, the rule clearly says that it's governed subject to the rules of civil procedure.
So we should just ignore the first sentence in there. So I mean, what would be the point of the first sentence if under your reading?
Under my reading, the first sentence specifically says the summary of investigation does not have to be disclosed. Everything else in the matter is governed by the rules of civil procedure. And the next section of that rule specifically says that. And if we look to the rules of civil procedure, work product is codified in Rule 26B3 of the Ohio Rules of Civil Procedure. And I do not interpret that rule as basically obliterating the concept of work product in these matters.
Counsel, are you saying that this document that we're talking about here was attorney's advice to the panel or to the investigative team about the legalities of the activity?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. It was a memorandum.
That would be an attorney-client argument. That's not what you asserted, right?
I think that the recommendations themselves in there are attorney-client privilege, but I think that the whole document is work product. Which I think both are applicable in this case. And, in terms of the work product issue, these are opinion work product. Not only some parts of it are privileged, but there's also opinion work product that receives near absolute protection for disclosure. And even ordinary fact work product, you have to show good cause to be entitled to turn over the work product. And that requires a showing of substantial need for the material, a showing that the material contains information that is important to the preparation of the party's case, and that the material is unavailable elsewhere. And the respondent made
under the civil rules, I almost feel like you're conflating the civil rules with 16B1G and the criminal rules, because the onus is on the party that's not producing to show why they're not producing it. It's not just automatically assumed work product, and then the other side has to overcome some burden here.
Yeah, I think we gave them what we're required to give them. We identified the two memos. We identified the author. We identified the addressee. We identified the date and the general subject matter of the memo, which I think is, you know, what's required to be turned over. And they provided absolutely nothing for a showing that there was any showing of need for this material, or that, you know, it was relevant, or that anything to overcome the either the attorney-client privilege or the work product privilege.
Counsel, in reading the recommendations and the report, there, I think on two separate occasions, I read that the respondent was offered the opportunity to proceed at the hearing and chose not to, with the presentation of witnesses or evidence or et cetera. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. During the course of the hearing, panel chair Green made it very clear that he was not, you know, he was not accepting the withdrawal of all the claims, that everything in the complaint was still on the table. He informed the parties if they had any other evidence that they'd like to put on with regard to those matters, that they were able to do so. However, you know, he did specifically say, if you're going to put on any evidence, it needs to be put on today. And counsel O'Shea had specifically asked him questions about that, about whether or not he'd be able to present additional evidence. And panel chair Green was very clear that once the proceedings are closed, there would be no more evidence. He did leave it open for mitigation evidence to be offered up. But other than that, you know, at the close of the hearing, panel chair Green made it very clear that there would be no additional evidence that was allowed. And also,
right, well, counsel, let me ask you then, you were ready, the relator was ready to, I guess, dismiss some of the charges, and the panel said, did not accept that. Is that my understanding? Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Did you then put on evidence of those charges to support the charges that were not going to be dismissed?
We in our questioning, Mr. Bruder, we did not specifically go into those things, but there are matters within the stipulations and the exhibits that do establish that these violations did in fact occur. There's sufficient facts in the record that these violations occurred. Additionally, you know, the panel was able to, the panel specifically asked some questions about, you know, matters outside the stipulated matters, and
asked that of whom?
Of Mr. Bruner when he was on the stand, the respondent. Panel chair or panel member Caruso asked him questions about many of the items that were, you know, outside the stipulation, and, you know, specifically asked him about those things. Mr. O'Shea objected during the course of the hearing, and panel chair Green said, no, we have not accepted the stipulations. The panel is still evaluating those charges. They're still on the table.
So your position would be combining the stipulations along with the testimony of Mr. Bruner, there was sufficient evidence to have this conclusion by the board and its recommendation.
Yes, Your Honor, that's absolutely correct.
And, all right, and then after Mr. Bruner was questioned, his counsel had the opportunity to present evidence. Did his counsel question him, his own client?
I do not believe that he questioned his client. If I don't recall for sure if he did, it was limited. But, you know, in this particular matter, you know, I think it was pretty clear that when first off, with regard to the Walton or Ortega matters on the, the 8.4C violations, there's evidence in the stipulations, in the stipulated exhibits, from Bruner's contradictory testimony in his deposition, his interview, all of which were properly admitted in this matter. In addition to his hearing testimony, there's sufficiently adequate information to find that there's conduct establishing those violations on the part of the respondent. And additionally, I think it's also important to note that I don't think that the panel found him credible when he was testifying in the hearing. Prior to the hearing, Mr. Bruner had already provided two or three different stories or recitations of facts on some of these charges during the course of the hearing, and they were changed. Some of those prior recitations of the fact were changed during the course of the hearing to provide yet another kind of accounting or story of what happened on some of those things.
Did the panel specifically reject the consent to discipline or any of the stipulations?
No, the joint stipulations were not rejected at all.
Okay, and what about the consent to discipline? Was that rejected?
There was a recommendation by a joint recommendation on sentencing that the panel, based on the additional violations, went with a different sanction. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
Well, I'm trying to get clear is the panel proceeds to a hearing when it rejects basically the settlement agreement between the parties. So did it reject that agreement?
No, Your Honor, it did not reject the agreement. It found violations for everything that was in the stipulated agreement. And additionally, based on the evidence that was in the record and Mr. Bruner's testimony on the day of the October 13th hearing, found two additional violations of professional conduct rule 8.4C with regard to the Walton matter and the Ortega matter, in addition to what was stipulated.
Thank you.
Counsel, there was no consent to discipline, was there?
No, Your Honor, there was not. There was a stipulated agreement entered into the evening before trial.
And that's very different in these proceedings than a settlement.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. Yes.
Thank you.
And I see that I'm over time, but
you are.
Okay. So I respectfully request that this court approve the Board of Professional Conduct's recommendations. And I'm happy to answer any other questions that you may have. If not, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. O'Shea.
Your Honor. If it pleases the court, to answer your questions, Justice DeWine and Justice Bruner, on the tyranny matter, I don't think you got a straight answer. In fact, the law that the Relators Council speaks of requires two things. One, they carry the burden. And secondly, they proffer what the documents that they're trying to protect on the record in camera so that the judge or the panel can make a recommendation, which could be reviewed by this court. You don't know what those were because they were never proffered. The biggest question, let me speak about the Reinheimer case. I read the Reinheimer case last night. The Reinheimer case says the exact opposite that what Relators Council is trying to tell you. It does not say the mere filing of a complaint is sufficient for due process. It said the exact opposite. So why they keep hammering away at Reinheimer as being supportive of their arguments is confusing to me. And one of the things that I heard is somehow I believe this court needs to say whether or not the board under the rules can start examining exhibits before the commencement of a hearing, because that's clearly what Mr. Caruso had done, because he started referring to things that had not even yet been presented or admitted into evidence when asking Mr. Bruner questions. The stipulations had only been presented to the panel really about an hour or so before the hearing commenced in October. So there's no way that the panel was able to review 50 to 60 exhibits in an hour. So somebody had begun to commence the review of exhibits prior to the commencement of the functional trial. We have a problem with that. And I think any defendant in any case in America would have a problem with the jury being shown exhibits before the first witness is called. The question that I asked myself last night, and I asked this panel to consider, is, does Mr. Bruner or anybody, any lawyer like Mr. Bruner, have less constitutional protections than Mr. Walton, Mr. Ortega, Mr. Harb, Mr. Russell, Mr. Jackson, Mr. Herron, or any other criminal defendant? According to Relator, he does. Less. He gets.
All right, counsel, let me ask you some of the about what was, when I asked the Relator about what evidence was presented, it was the stipulations that was before the panel, as well as your client's own testimony. Is that correct?
That was what I believe Relator believes the evidence is, but the panel chair, Mr. Green, Justice O'Connor, made it very clear on page 76 of the transcript, it's attached to our brief, that they can consider anything. The panel could consider anything, be it in the stipulations or not.
Counsel, they had a combination of the stipulations. There were some charges that they wanted to pursue that apparently the Relator would have been satisfied not pursuing, and or some violations, I should say. The panel then asked your client about those violations, and his testimony was the basis for their findings.
May I respectfully disagree, Justice O'Connor, because the transcript is everything, and we cannot have myself, we cannot have Mr. Roberts tell you what's in the transcript. We can only look at the transcript. The transcript was attached to our objections in its entirety. I asked the court to look at the transcript. Don't take my word for it. Don't take Mr. Roberts' word for it in argument. The transcript tells us everything. That's why we have them. And on page 76 of that transcript, again, may I direct the court to take a look at that again, because the panel chair said, the panel get to look at everything, stipulations or not. And apparently Mr. Caruso proved his point when he started asking Mr. Bruner about exhibits that he clearly had started reading before the commencement of the hearing. That completely blew due process out of the water, completely made us all unprepared, including Relator, for what was going to happen.
Counsel, let me ask you the final question then, because you're over your time. You said that you were not, I got the impression from your previous presentation that you were precluded from offering testimony here. Is that your position?
I don't want to get involved with semantics, Your Honor, and please take that. We were ready to try Walton and Ortega. That weekend before we reached a deal, they were going to back off on the 8.4C parts of Walton or Ortega for reasons that we set out pretty clearly in our brief. But when we came to the hearing, we thought it more of a plea, and obviously we go second, Your Honor, and if they were going to rest their 8.4C violations solely on Mr. Bruner's testimony at the hearing, as well as the exhibits, whether they be part of the stipulations or the exhibits that have been filed for the board, and which are part of the record here, prior to the hearing, we just don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor. And it's the board's decision doesn't make that clear, whether they're looking at exhibits that were filed before, that were part of the stipulations. And I asked the court to take a look at Mr. Bruner's testimony under oath. He was never asked about the 8.4C issues on Ortega or on Walton. He was never asked about that.
Counsel, maybe just yes or no. Were you precluded? Was it your decision as the attorney not to present evidence at this panel hearing?
Absolutely.
It was.
Mr. O'Shea, I need to follow up. So the stipulated agreement, did you consider it a consent to discipline?
Absolutely. A functional consent to discipline. Everybody did. That's why we had stipulated sanctions, stipulated exhibits, all of the above, Justice Bruner.
And the documents that the panel was reviewing, were those documents previously filed in the record?
They are. As a matter of fact, they are referenced in the docket 3941, 51 of the docket, board docket that was sent over to this court. The filing of those exhibits occurred a couple of days before the October hearing.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under.
Can I ask one? I'm sorry, Chief. Can I ask one quick question? Is there anything, are the documents that are allegedly work product that we were discussing, were they proffered? Are they in the record anywhere?
Absolutely, we're not. And I, if you excuse the expression, Your Honor, I complained and whined about that consistently in the motion practice.
You asked for it to be proffered?
Absolutely. It's in our motion, in our brief in opposition to their motion to quash.
All right. Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.
Thank you.